You're listening to the Sex and Psychology Podcast, the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Lay Miller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. In the previous episode, we talked all about how psychedelic treatments can assist in the world of sex therapy. If you haven't listened to that show yet, go back and check it out because it provides important background information for this episode. In today's show, we're going to continue our deep dive into psychedelic-assisted sex therapy by exploring some of the very important ethical and legal considerations. For example, how does consent work when patients are under the influence of a psychedelic drug? And how do therapists maintain appropriate ethical boundaries when working with clients who are in this altered and potentially vulnerable state? Likewise, what is the safety profile of psychedelic drugs? And what do people need to know about using them in order to be informed consumers? Lastly, what does the legal landscape look like for psychedelic-assisted treatments? And for people who might be interested in exploring this kind of therapy, what should they be looking for, and what are the red flags that they should avoid? I am joined once again by Jeff Lundgren, a licensed clinical mental health counselor, ASEX-certified sex therapist, and psychedelic-assisted therapy provider. He runs a private practice based in Salt Lake City, Utah. He is author of the new book, Unfolding Eros, A Journey into Psychedelic-Assisted Sex Therapy. This is going to be another fascinating conversation that you won't want to miss. Stick around, and we're going to jump in right after the break. If you love the science of sex as much as I do, consider becoming a friend of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. The Kinsey Institute is the world's premier research organization on sex and relationships, and you can help them continue the legacy of Dr. Alfred Kinsey, whose pioneering research changed everything we think we know about sex. Visit kinseyinstitute.org to make an impact. Your donations can help support ongoing research projects on critical topics. You can also show your support by following Kinsey Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for supporting sex science. Okay, Jeff, let's dive into ethical and legal considerations for using psychedelics in sex therapy. And the place I want to begin is with the issue of consent. So there are a lot of people who believe that if you're under the influence or you're in an altered state in any way, that you can't provide consent. So if a therapist is engaging in psychedelic-assisted therapy with a client, the client's decision-making might be impaired while the drug is in their system. So what kinds of safeguards do practitioners need to be thinking about in order to minimize potential risk of harm while that patient is in this heightened state of vulnerability?
I think that you described the risk accurately, where normally an individual would have the stamina to say no or to articulate something unwanted or perhaps even request something, it's impaired. And clinicians in holding space, whether these are non-licensed guides or licensed practitioners, having an awareness of the vulnerability is really important. So there's a couple of things that we look at from a therapeutic perspective. One is conversations have to be included prior to a medicine session and contracting about what is and is not okay ever, what the client may be open to, not as necessarily an invitation from the practitioner, but the client may respond to a question such as, how would a therapeutic touch, like holding your hand or a hand on your shoulder, what would that feel like to you? Would that feel supportive or threatening for you? Or give me some feedback, and then have the client volunteer where they come from and what's appropriate for them. And those contracts are immutable. So we don't go into a medicine session and then they say, actually, I'm really okay with this now. You can hold my hand now. Yeah, I appreciate that. But we had decided previously that that wouldn't be okay with you. And so I want to honor that. And these are things that the therapist or the guide is the stalwart defender of. The other thing I think is helpful when we talk about protecting that vulnerable space, some of these medicines, they invoke a lot of new acceptance or new capacity to stretch boundaries that they may have not been okay with. MDMA most notably. So the MAPS research and their approach in their protocol has been to include a second clinician. There's some logistical reasons as to why that's helpful, but in this way, it's helpful so that another clinician is supporting protecting the client's interest where perhaps that environment in unfortunate and I think less common situations could be problematic.
Okay, so there's lots of things to take into account here. One is the importance of that informed consent at the outset and establishing clearly what the boundaries are and then maintaining those boundaries and potentially having some other safeguards in place, like an extra clinician who's monitoring and ensuring that protocols and other things like that, safety standards, boundaries are respected. Now, you kind of hinted at something that you talk about in your book, which is this idea of psychological transference. And I've actually been wanting to do some episodes like specifically on that topic and do a deep dive into it, but I'd like to touch on it briefly here. So can you please define for my audience what transference is in a therapeutic context in general? And then why do we need to think about transference specifically in this medication-assisted therapy context?
Justin, I love this question. It's a powerful dialogue to engage in. So transference is the psychological experience of transposing the client's feelings or thinking onto the therapist, or the therapist in response to the client's situation, transposing their beliefs or thinking onto the client. And we call this transference and countertransference. Simply put, in a layman's term, it's projection. It's interesting that when a client is in an altered state of consciousness, and in this context, we're talking about psychedelics, that the intensity of transference in both from the clinician to the client and from the client to the practitioner is enhanced by an order of magnitude. So oftentimes people will think, this is such easy work, right? Especially with ketamine. It's got to be easy because ketamine is an anesthetic. And even when we're talking about low dosages, they're kind of just laying there in their own space. Yet, in ways I can't understand, though I can describe, the space that's being held by the clinician is completely full of the emotional and thought roller coaster of that altered state of consciousness, making it very important for the clinician to be extremely aware of all of those transferring energies. And I don't know why this happens. I just know that this happens. And everyone that I'm familiar with, my colleagues that work in this way, they all have and share this sentiment.
Yeah. To me, it makes sense why transference happens. I mean, my lay theory of it is that it's an outgrowth of empathy to some degree, like where we're just kind of connecting with that other person. And in a therapeutic context, you've got this dynamic human interaction and you've got this level of vulnerability that might be enhanced in the case of psychedelic assisted therapy. And so, you know, it just kind of makes sense that this projection, if you will, is going to happen to some degree. But when people talk about transference, they often talk about it in the form of kind of an erotic transference, right? Which is just one form in which it can take, where people might project romantic feelings or attraction, either from the direction of the client to the therapist or the other way around. It's an uncomfortable topic that people don't like to acknowledge, but it does potentially happen sometimes. And in the case of psychedelic assisted therapy, you know, you mentioned MDMA and how that might potentially create some of these feelings of bondedness, maybe lead people to cross boundaries. Can you just talk a little bit more about erotic transference specifically and how that intersects with the psychedelic assisted therapy?
So the street name, or one of the street names for MDMA, is ecstasy. And it's labeled that because that's kind of what it does. For most, there's a very strong sense of euphoria. And because it includes this bliss, it has a very strong sexual, I think is a really appropriate word, effect. And if the therapist is observing a client having a physiological response to this, then part of that transference in this way could be the response that the therapist receives that might activate their own sexual arousal. It would be very helpful then to know, oh, of course, this is exciting. Like I of course I would respond like this. And having the guardrails of understanding is really helpful in this way. Not being mindful of it, or that that's even a thing, then you could possibly, and let's assume that this doesn't happen much, that we'll make it uncommon. It would be unfortunate if clinicians were not responsive to that possibility.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a complicated subject, but you're so right that if we don't talk about it, then we can't create the boundaries and guardrails that are going to prevent people from acting on it and then crossing certain professional barriers and other things like that. So, you know, at some point, I'm going to do a deep dive into transference and countertransference and, you know, how these things are more specifically managed just in general in a therapeutic context, because I think it's such an important topic. Okay, let's talk about potential side effects and health risks for a moment. So when taking any kind of substance, there's always potential for adverse effects because everybody's body processes substances differently. And in the case of psychedelics, there's a lot that we hear about in the popular media and on social media, ranging from somebody potentially having a quote-unquote bad trip to becoming dependent on the drug, to developing psychosis or mental and physical health problems. And so a lot of people have read or heard about things that might make psychedelics sound scary. So in the case of using them in a therapeutic context, what do we know about the safety profile and what do people need to know about potential risks in order to be informed consumers?
Thankfully, what we know, and this is established fairly firmly, and I should say on the onset too, I'm not a medical provider. So a lot of this is just my own understanding from the education I do have as a part of my certification. But what we understand about psychedelics is the risk profile of these medicines is actually quite low. Remarkably, even drugs that carry a very strong stigma of threat, like LSD, are really no more dangerous than an aspirin, for at least from a physiological response, a biological impact. We do know that the psychological footprint of psychedelics can leave an impact. So there are some contraindications that most providers would be sensitive to. And we know that there's a physiological response that's common among these medications that may warrant an individual not being an appropriate candidate. Having said that, again, the profile and the risk associated with these things is remarkably low. Much of the research that's measured the amount of emergency room visits from psychedelics shows that this is the case in comparison to other substances that we widely accept as safe, like alcohol, are dramatically more risky. Yet, you know, we regulate these things differently, which is an interesting paradox. So with more specificity, psychedelics, in because they activate neurochemistry, often do things like increase heart rate. So individuals that have a history of cardiovascular disease might want to consult with their physician before taking a psychedelic. That would be one. Another is any kind of pharmacological use of serotonergic drugs. Most notably would be MAOIs. There are a small set of drugs that will inhibit MAO as a way to increase the amount of dopamine or serotonin that's available, because MAO is the one of the enzymes that break that down. However, because some of these medications like ayahuasca as a plant medicine also include an MAOI, and anytime we're interacting with the serotonergic system, we need to be mindful of overstraining that system. There is, and people will find this, the fear of contracting or receiving serotonin syndrome. It's remarkably rare. So mostly what we're dealing with is not so much the biological effect. And because these medicines don't really interact with the dopamine system, we're not really talking about physiological addictions in comparison to drugs like heroin or methamphetamines that do strongly. So we're not really having to be so much concerned about that, as much as we might be more mindful of its psychological effects. This is why set and setting are super critical. This is why integration is important. This is why polydrug use is also a significant thing that any journeyer should consider. And we hear stories about people that, you know, venture in reckless domains. Yet at the same time, the emergency room is not flooded with these people. So that's kind of how I would look and apply risk prevention in terms of the footprint with psychedelics.
So when used in a therapeutic context at a therapeutic dose, so we're talking about, you know, low and controlled safety profile, probably relatively low, but there's lots of individual considerations to take into account because, you know, as we said, different people might process or interact with the drug in different ways because we all have different bodies, different health conditions. And so that's where kind of having like a thorough medical assessment beforehand is important. And it, you know, ties in with my next question, which was about kind of like just the general safety protocol. If you're going to offer psychedelic assisted therapy, like some of the things that you need to have in place. And so you have a whole chapter in your book that deals with this. And it starts first with understanding the patient's health history, mental health history, these other sorts of things to make sure they're a good candidate. What are some other things that would be part of that safety protocol to make sure that you're protecting patient safety and reducing risk of harm if you're engaged in this psychedelic assisted therapy?
So there's the physiological aspect of reducing risk. There's also the psychological. If an individual has a history of psychosis, bipolar 1, or schizophrenia. Even though we know that psychedelics do not cause these disorders, we don't want to induce psychedelics in a psychotic state that would be problematic. So there's a psychological assessment or awareness that's important here. We would also look at relational factors. So if we're talking about psychedelic-assisted sex therapy, I might recommend that if the couple is participating in the medicine session, that we may want to address relationship factors that could be destructive because the setting, the environment in which one participates in the medicine strongly influences the therapeutic outcome. So we want to eliminate any confounding complications and address those early on, or at least be aware of them. There is an important factor in being aware of trauma history. We could not predict how any one individual would respond with a psychedelic or due to a psychedelic in response to a trauma history. So that's important to suss out and be aware of.
Yeah. So it's not as simple as patient comes in and you're just like, here, let's microdose some drugs and go, right? You know, there's so many things that you need to take into account beforehand. And this is a, you know, very tightly controlled and monitored situation because there are things that can potentially go wrong. And so you've got to put a lot of these safety protocols and safeguards in place in order to not just shield yourself from liability if you're a provider, but also to protect the patient's health and safety in that therapeutic context.
And licensed providers are in an interesting dilemma. So today, hopefully appropriately trained, we can use ketamine psychiatrically, but we're also aware, and most people are very eager to start using these other medications therapeutically. So today we tend to lump pathology underneath one interventive umbrella. Oh, ketamine does that. Oh, by the way, ketamine does that too. But at some point, we'll be assessing, no, MDMA is the best psychedelic medication for you. Oh, actually, we need to go to a plant medicine for you. So what's the rubric to do that with? Who's doing that? Is this the medical provider? Is this the therapist or some well-trained or experienced shaman? So there's a lot of factors that we juggle around today due to legal constraints, but ultimately, when we're coming at it from a professional perspective under the scope of a professional license, there is an onboarding with the safety factors as a part of those early discussions.
Right. So what is the current legal landscape for psychedelic assisted sex therapy? Where is it currently legal? And how much of this is taking place underground outside of legal frameworks?
It's an evolving landscape for sure. And internationally, there are some jurisdictions that have promoted an early adoption, very progressive attitude towards psychedelics. The Netherlands comes to mind. There are places that have a rich heritage in psychedelics, mostly in Central and South America, where the use of these things ceremonially continue, although they've been legally challenged. In the United States, there are some states, and a lot of this trend is on the back of the legalization and recreational use of cannabis. So jurisdictions like Oregon took an approach, which has been both helpful and not. We've seen some cities and municipalities within California, Denver City, and more recently, generally in Colorado, a different approach than what Oregon has chose to do. And there's some other jurisdictions in the eastern part of the United States. DC has decriminalized many things. And there are some other cities in that that are now starting to say, hey, we need to look at this. I live in Utah, which is a very conservative state. And up until, I would say, a year ago, the discussion was very diminished and it was small. And recently, the governor of the state of Utah has signed a bill with the unanimous support of the state legislature to bring psilocybin treatment into the state. Now, it's an early part of the conversation, so we're not sure where this would go. But I think with the advancement of MDMA in conjunction with FDA-designed trials and the schedule to both reclassify that drug and apply an exemption should open the door to MDMA in 2024, and likely we'll see psilocybin roll out in some way in which I don't know that we know within the year following.
So in terms of current legal frameworks, it's pretty spotty. And there are people who are practicing outside of those legal frameworks. So, you know, just because a government might say this is legal or government regulated or something, it doesn't mean that everybody who is practicing in that area is practicing within the legal framework. People sometimes practice outside of that. But in order to accommodate like expansion or growth of psychedelic assisted sex therapy, how do the laws need to change? I mean, it seems to me that it's actually probably a pretty heavy lift in a lot of ways, because you're going to need to have some combination of either legalization or decriminalization of the substance, coupled with loosening restrictions on research, coupled with establishing formal treatment guidelines, plus some type of licensing and training board. So in other words, it's not as simple as just like you can wave the pen and expand access overnight, right? Like this is something that's going to be years in the making before it's something that would be like considered widely available or mainstream.
And here's where the dilemma occurs. We have religious exemption in the United States for the use of psilocybin or magic mushrooms and ayahuasca and mescaline, mostly in like the Native American church. So respectfully, I think most lawmakers understand the importance of honoring those traditions and right of individuals to explore spiritual sacrament with the use of plant medicines and psychedelics. And we can't avoid the reality of the transformation that's occurring within the mental health space underground. However, some of the guides associated with those approaches are untrained or perhaps even destructive due to ignorance or malicious intent to harm. Unfortunately, that happens. And then we have on the outskirts these licensed professionals that are eager to incorporate these medicines and approaches into mental health generally. So lawmakers are saying on one hand, we need to do something to put guidelines around the protocols and the boards and the licensing and all of the things that we think are wonderful in Western approaches. Yet we have these competing ideals from religion, cultural backgrounds, recreational use in some cases, and underground movements that are not always bad. In fact, most of the time, it's actually because of the profile of these medicines, they're really effective. So they're highly motivated to do something, but I don't know that everybody knows what to do yet.
Yeah, and I appreciate you sharing that because it points to just how complex and complicated this issue was. You know, I thought the way I had laid it out in my question presented it in a complicated enough way, but then you added some additional layers of nuance complicated there, which, yeah, makes me think about how it's even more complicated than I originally thought. Now, you also brought up something about how there are some people who are out there who are offering these services who might be unlicensed, untrained, might not necessarily have best intentions. Maybe they're just out there to make money. And so, you know, there are people who are looking to access psychedelic assisted therapy or sex therapy. You got all these people offering services. Some of them, you know, might be traveling outside of the country and there are lofty promises like you'll have the trip of your life. And I mean, trip as in, you know, psychedelic trip. But you know, many of them are not professionals or credentialed. So, you know, if somebody is thinking about giving this a try, and they're seeing things that are out there, what are things that they should keep an eye out for? And what might be some red flags?
Yeah, red flags. We'll start with that one. If the offering appears too good to be true, that's a red flag. Sometimes it doesn't work. If the offering is extremely expensive, something's off. Psychedelic treatments are expensive because they're time consuming, but we're talking about outliers that are astronomically expensive. Things that are new or they seem novel in a way like, well, we have our own special formula of probably something to avoid. If the names of the individuals are hidden or shielded, some people work underground, but they don't hide their identity. But if there is no person behind the website, probably something you should probably avoid. If it appears that their use of the medicine is reckless in terms of legality, or perhaps they decline from even approaching assessment for qualifying participation, that's probably something to avoid because they're probably more interested in the money than the safety of the journeyer. Things to look for would be qualified referrals, asking perhaps a therapist or within their network of programs that they're familiar with. There are some programs and experiences that are connected with evolving and emerging jurisdictional oversight. So there's an appeal, for example, to travel to a place like Oregon as an example, and then work with someone who has been certified or has been approved as a certified provider for those medicines. And even though one would have to travel there, again, that's outside, these are good things to look for. I think another thing that's helpful is, are they including pre-flight instructions? Is there a moment of processing to get to know and establish the set and setting and set intentions and get to know the person or people that you're working with? Are they talking about integration? And even if integration isn't included in their program, are they able to then refer and or connect you back to perhaps your therapist or someone else that can help to do that work for you? These are important aspects. Otherwise, we're just talking about recreational use and you're just taking a drug and having fun, which that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But therapeutically, we would look for something more.
Yeah. You know, everything you described there, I think is great as applied to psychedelic assisted therapy, but especially with regard to the red flags, almost everything you said is a red flag with regard to anything in the sexual health and wellness industry that people should know about, right? If something sounds too good to be true, it is, right? And the world of sexual health and wellness, unfortunately, there are so many people who just make those really big, lofty promises, charge exorbitant sums by preying on people's insecurities, and they make a killing on it in terms of their profit, but they're not actually helping people, and it's very predatory. So, you know, I appreciate you sharing all of that. I just wanted to say, I think it's good general advice for any type of sexual health and wellness product that's on the market.
There's two general indicators of competency in this intersection. So when we're talking about sexual therapy, looking to an ASECT certified provider or educator is a really good indicator of quality care, opposed to, yes, I do sex therapy and I took a weekend course on sexuality. That is insufficient. In a similar way, if the therapist or individual providing a therapeutic approach with a psychedelic has not participated in a certified program that at least spans many months, we're talking 200-hour programs, it's insufficient. It's not enough for them. They may be competent and maybe they're working in conjunction with somebody who has that background and certification, but these are important things to look at. No different than what you would do if you had cancer, you would probably go seek out a board-certified oncologist.
Yeah. So if you're interested in this, do your homework. Don't just go for the first thing that you see online, especially if the promises sound very lofty and if the price tag is very high. So thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Jeff. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work and to get a copy of your new book?
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. So the book can be found just about anywhere. It's called Unfolding Eros, A Journey into Psychedelic Assisted Sex Therapy. They can find me online at jefflundgren.com, and I work in a private practice, Oak Branch Counseling in Salt Lake City, Utah. And you can find that online as well.
Well, thanks again for your time. I really appreciate having you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lee Miller and Instagram at Justin J. Lee Miller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.